Court of Appeals. We have two cases set at 1:30 for oral argument and another set at 3 o'clock this afternoon for oral argument. Your panel this afternoon is, to my right, Justice Wade Birdwell, and to my left, Justice Dana Womack, and I'm Lee Gabriel. So if the clerk will call the first case, we'll get started.
The court will now call case Waterman versus DTSFRL1 LLC. May it please the court, Mr. John R. Kerr will argue for the appellant. Mr. Tony Nowers will argue for the appellate.
All right. Mr. Carr, you may proceed.
Thank you very much. Good afternoon, judges. My name again is John Carr. I know it's spelled K-E-R, but it's pronounced Carr. Thank you very much for correcting that, too. I'd like to first acknowledge my error in my original brief concerning the assertion of the findings of fact and conclusions of law. They were not entered. That was my mistake. But even so, it is the position of the appellant that there is no theory under which the trial court judgment can be sustained. And in that respect, we have five arguments. The first of all, that the boundary line agreement that is in issue, what I'll call the BLA if that's okay, was not a contract because it had no or inadequate consideration and there was no meeting of the minds between the parties on the essential terms. Secondly, that even if the BLA did establish a contract, there was a complete failure of consideration which made the contract voidable. A third, the relationship between the owners and tenants of, actually the owners of both lots 7 and 8, was that of a licensee and licensor, not a not an easement itself. Fourthly, that the appellee failed in its burden to establish entitlement to an implied easement, and that specifically concerns the where there is an implied easement by reservation. The Texas Supreme Court in the trio of cases I cited in my brief requires strict necessity, and that was not shown, completely failed in that showing. And then lastly, the awarding of a permanent injunction and damages plus attorney's fees, we assert was an abuse of discretion and legally and factually insufficient and frankly a miscarriage of justice. I'd like to address first the BLA, the boundary line agreement. That was a document that was drafted by Miss Janes. Miss Janes was the owner of both Lot 7 and Lot 8, and then when she sold Lot 7 to a Miss Mooney, this boundary line agreement came up, and Miss Janes testified that she drafted that boundary line agreement maybe with the help of a realtor and while drinking some wine. But there were no negotiations between Janes and Mooney with respect to that boundary line agreement. There was no discussion whatsoever. The first that Miss Mooney even knew about an assertion of a boundary line agreement was at the closing. The process of closing in this case was Ms. Janes.
But at the time of the transaction, that fence was in place.
I'm sorry?
At the time of that transaction, that fence was in place.
The fence was in place, yes.
So Mooney, in purchasing the property, knew that that fence was exactly where it was at the time she purchased it, and she negotiated for purchase of the property with it being encumbered by that fence.
Yes, sir, she did know about it, and the boundary line agreement states the word she consents to that. And a consent is terms that apply more to a license than to an easement. Remember, there was no easement in the deed. There's no easement in any deed whatsoever. There is never a document that refers to an easement. So the fact that Miss Mooney was aware of the fence, she certainly can't agree to have that encroachment for what she understood was the purpose.
Okay, where in your pleadings do you make the argument that this was a license and therefore was revocable at will by Ms. Mooney?
It is in Judge, in a general denial. This is not an argument about license versus an easement is not subject to Rule 93 requiring affirmative pleadings. And we filed affirmative pleadings for failure consideration. We also filed a general denial, and that general denial places all matters in issue. And even though Mr. Mahlers in his brief referred to, well, I just barely touched on license at the trial court, My point there was, and it's frankly is the same here, that the at best, this boundary line agreement creates only a license or a licensee relationship, not an easement relationship. Consenting to a seeing a fence and saying, being told, and what she was told was that, we believe then perhaps this is so that the tenants of the apartment building might have an easier way of getting out in the event of a fire. Don't forget, though, that when Miss Janes bought that property, both lots 7 and 8, she bought them at the same time, there was a fence on the property line. She even called the fire department there in Grapevine and asked them to take a look at it and see if this is okay. And the fire department representative, according to what Miss Janes testified to in her deposition, said everything is fine. You know, the fence there is fine. Now, there is a perpendicular fence that is attached to the apartment complex, and then you have the boundary line fence as well. So it might be a tight squeeze, but don't forget also that the fire person said these apartments under the code only require one entrance and exit. So there was no necessity to move the fence. It was all gratuitous. So if it's gratuitous and without compensation by the tenants, then it is certainly a license. That she could have removed that fence back to the property line herself if she wanted to. When she sold to Miss Mooney and Miss Mooney consented to the encroachment, Miss Mooney likewise could have moved that fence back over, but for what this boundary line agreement is talking about, and that's where I'm coming to, that there's no consideration or inadequate consideration. But even if there was adequate consideration, there's a complete failure of consideration. The boundary line agreement only expresses the ownership of the two lots as consideration, plus other good and valuable consideration, which, as you know, is a rebuttable presumption. Well, that presumption, I questioned Miss Janes in her deposition. What was the consideration? She said, well, I was going to keep the kids. There was at one point in time, there was a nursery in one of the apartments. Give some room for the kids. Have more additional rooms so that you don't have to crawl between the perpendicular fence and the boundary line fence. And that she was going to maintain that lot 8 would maintain the fence. Well, the only evidence of any maintenance of that fence came from Miss Janes, and she said, well, I painted the fence and I may have replaced the board. When Miss Mooney purchased that property, she testified that from the day she owned it until she transferred the property to the appellant, there was absolutely no maintenance on that fence.
What's the current status of the fence?
Oh, it's about to fall on the ground.
Okay, let me ask you this. When you look at the plat, okay, with the 4.5-foot fence, there was originally a fence that went from Estel back to the back of the property of both plot 8 and lot
along
7.
The property line,
right?
Yes,
right,
sir.
Along the property line. Okay, so when you look at that plat, is there still a fence there along the property line?
No, sir.
No.
Hang on. I'm sorry.
Along the property line to the point where you then have the added fence pop out the 4.5 feet. That's what I'm looking at in terms of the plat. In other words, it looks like basically it gets right up to the building, and then it takes an immediate left turn. If you're walking down the property line between 7 and 8, and you're basically balancing on what was the original fence, right as you get to the building, all of a sudden it takes an immediate left-hand turn. That was the new fence that Ms. Janes put in that encumbered lot 7. It goes 4.5 feet, and then it takes another right-hand turn, goes down to a little bit past the building, the fourplex, and then it makes another right-hand turn and then reattaches to the original boundary line fence and makes and finishes out going to the back of both properties. Is that correct?
I believe, Judge, that from Estill Street, which faces the lot 7 faces.
Right.
I don't believe there was a fence from the boundary line fence to Estill Street. I think that was without a fence. On the backside, however, forgive me, I don't remember the name of the street,
Austin, I think.
I think it is Austin, yes, sir. There is a fence there now because Ms. Schwindemann reconstructed a fence. I don't believe it was all the way to from the property line to the encroachment fence at the edge of the apartment complex. I could be wrong on that. My memory is not real clear, but I know that Ms.
Fence in question is attached to, is it attached to the original boundary line fence?
It may have been.
She didn't just build a fence.
No, sir, she didn't just.
Everything that's being told to us in the briefing is that fence moved. There was an original fence. The original fence was taken down to create this 4.5
yes, sir.
Foot space.
Yes, sir.
Okay. But it was attached to the original fence.
Yes, sir. I believe it from the to the Austin Street. Again, I don't think there was a fence from the edge of the apartment complex towards Estelle Street.
Okay. Okay, go ahead.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Well, it is our position that there's no contract because of inadequate consideration or lack of a meeting of the minds. That if you look closely, and we're limited to this document, this boundary line agreement as to what it says, it does not say anything about who may use that encroachment area and who may not use that encroachment area. It simply says there is a fence there, and you may not initiate legal or equitable action to move it. My client did not do that. We didn't initiate any action. But the fence itself is about to fall down. If it's about to fall down, nobody's maintained it, and so there was a failure consideration. I'd like to, while I can, move on to the implied easements, unless y'all have some other questions for me on the BLA. With respect to the implied easements, there are the Texas Supreme Court in that trio of cases of Hamrick, Dry, and Ward, it set out that in an implied easement, especially if it's an implied easement respecting the reservation of an easement, the standard is strict necessity. Strict necessity is an objective standard. As set out in the Dry case, it talks about access, ingress, and egress. It talks about water and sewer lines. It talks about air and light, party walls, things that are objective in nature. We have none of that, and there's no proof of strict necessity. Now, the appellee has said, well, Ms. James thought that it was necessary. Well, the subjective understanding of the proponent of it does not rise to the level of strict necessity on an objective standard. That is the first point about the implied easement, is that there is a complete failure to establish a strict necessity. That failure to do so renders the judgment of the court that there finds an implied easement wrong. It's a misapplication of the law. The judge went further to say, well, not only is it going to be an implied easement, but it's going to be everything associated with ownership, with the exception of paying the taxes, is going to fall on the appellant. That is a miscarriage of justice, especially in view of that trio of cases that I've cited to you. I believe I got 2 minutes left. There's no deed granting an easement. The BLA does not grant an easement, so it must be an implied easement. There are two types here. There's by prior use and by equitable estoppel. The appellee has argued equitable estoppel because Ms. Mooney signed the BLA. That took place after Ms. James had already signed. She wasn't present at closing. There had been no discussions about the BLA. So a signing of the BLA after Ms. James has already completed and fully performed her part of the transaction cannot be a misrepresentation. Lastly, the judge awarded $500, you know, to replace those two gates. The gates were originally on lot 7 completely. Miss Once a tenant exits the gate or in order to enter the gate, had to be a trespasser on lot 7.
New fencing that's been put up, are those gates actually blocked, and does it?
The old ones are, yes, sir.
Okay.
They sure
are. Does that block the egress from the building?
No, sir. You know what had to happen? They needed to put up new gates on lot 8, and that's what they did. You know, now they didn't like it, but Miss Schwindemann has every right to prevent trespass on her land, even if there's the encroachment is consented to by Miss Mooney. To exit that encroachment area, they automatically become a trespasser. She has every right to stop that.
Were people using the gates while Ms. Mooney
owned
it?
Sure. But that
they they weren't using the gates to escape fires, were they?
There has never been a fire there, to my knowledge. So the answer to that would be no. They're not using that gate to escape a fire. I see my time is up. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Mr. Mallers.
May it please the court. I'm Tony Mallers, representing BTSFRL 1 LLC, the owner of Lot 8. In a case like this where there's no findings of fact or conclusions of law that have been brought forward, we believe that the judgment has to be affirmed on any basis that on any legal theory that finds support in the evidence. We know that. Even though there is legally and factually sufficient evidence to support this particular judgment, and that means the enforceability of the boundary line agreement, which was signed in the course of the same closing, the same transaction and occurrence as the sale of Lot 7. Therefore, the case law is very clear back from the Supreme Court in Jones v. Kelly in 1981 that those documents are read together as part of a single transaction. And
isn't an implied easement, though,
yes, sir,
based upon actual activity, not conditional activity? And the conditional activity here was use during a fire incident, and that's never actually been used in that way over the 11 years?
Well, the record is it's not clear. There's nothing in the record about whether there has been a fire in the 11 years, so I will accept that.
Well, I mean, most of the cases were cited to are instances where somebody's actually using the property to either get somewhere, go someplace,
right,
using it for some activity, okay,
yes,
and over time, whether a prior use or that type of thing.
Yes, sir.
Here, the entire predicate for this property is a just in case. We're going to do this just in case type of thing. It's not for any actual activity, just possible activity. And
well,
so has an implied easement ever been found by the Texas courts based upon a conditional use?
Well, I assume, I mean, I haven't seen anything exactly on point to that, but I assume that for, you know, it is possible that any use could be a conditional use because we don't know exactly when we're going to use it until we use it for that purpose. If you're asking, has it ever been used for a fire escape? I have no knowledge of that. The record doesn't reflect that it has been, but my thought on that, Your Honor, is that at the beginning when Ms. Janes had ownership of both lots and the fire department came out, it is not correct to say that the fire department said the location of that fence was okay. What the fire department said is that things are okay here, but with the fence in that location, there's going to be a problem with people getting out, or they're going to have to crawl through narrow spaces in order to get out. And because of her concern, based on what the fireman told her back in 2004 when she bought this property, she moved that fence and allowed the tenants in the fourplex on Lot 8 to be able to have that extra space in case of a fire. Now, this is a little bit of a, I guess you could look at this as a little bit of a different situation, because you kind of hope that an emergency like people having to escape from fires never does happen, and perhaps it was a precautionary thing based on what the fire department told her, the fireman told her, but it was recognized not only by Ms. Janes, who went to the extent of buying the next lot, Lot 7, in order to be able to move this fence, but it was also recognized by Ms. Mooney at closing, and she herself said, well, they told me this was for a fire escape, or for fire reasons, and I felt that that was a valid reason. So the question in my mind is, have we met the elements? Is there sufficient elements in the record for an implied easement by prior use? I would just want to get this out before I forget about it in getting
But the use that it's being used for is not the one that it was represented to be for. Okay, so it's used.
Yes.
Recreationally.
Correct.
So the kids play, et cetera, et cetera. But none of that had anything to do with the fire exit. For which it was.
I would just go back to the elements. When in doubt, I go back to the elements and see if there's evidence in the record of those elements. We had unitary ownership. We had continuous open and apparent use. The question is whether there's strict necessity, in my opinion. And the question is that whether or not a use for as a fire escape was ever actually used, that doesn't mean that such a use isn't still necessary in case it becomes necessary for those people who might not be able to get out the front door to jump down on from the second floor to get out. The answer to your question is I've not seen a case that talks about conditional use. I have not. However, I think if we look at the issue.
On top of this, easements usually anticipate that the owner of the property that's impaired still has some type of access to it and can use it consistent with the easement. This, you got a fence that blocks any and all access to a piece of the property that she's paying taxes for.
Understood.
It looks more like an adverse possession than it does some type of implied easement.
Well, the boundary line agreement.
Because that's effectively what you've gotten a judgment for now.
Yes, sir.
You've got an easement that effectively says, we have complete control over this property, and not only that, but we can exclude her from the property that she owes taxes on and she pays taxes on.
But I would say that the evidence in the record shows that the parties were in agreement with that. If you look at Ms. Mooney, she was.
If the parties were in agreement with that, then I would expect the deed of trust to reflect that, in fact, that property had actually been deeded over. But it wasn't. There's nothing in anything with regard to the transaction with Mooney that indicated that that 4.5-foot stretch was in any way, shape, or form intended to be deeded over.
Well, no, and I'm not saying it was intended to be deeded over. I'm saying that either through the doctrine of implied easement by prior use or implied easement by estoppel, that Ms. Mooney was aware of the encroachment, was aware that the people that were tenants in Lot 8 were using it and didn't have a problem with it, didn't touch the fence for 4 years, didn't have any problems with the people that were tenants. All of this was on file with the boundary line agreement, and the appellant in this particular case, Ms. Mooney's mother-in-law, had constructive notice about it, had spoken to her daughter-in-law about it 1.5 years before the closing, before she decided to purchase it, and still purchased it. So the question then becomes the location of the fence, coupled with the knowledge of Ms. Mooney before she closed as to what this was being used for, and the lack of any argument, the lack of even touching that fence, the lack of trying, there's no evidence in the record that they tried to use that 4.5 feet for themselves, if that doesn't qualify as strict necessity for implied easement by prior use, it certainly qualifies as sufficient evidence for an implied easement by estoppel. The representation was the signing of the BLA agreement, boundary line agreement, by Ms. Mooney at the closing with knowledge of the encroachment and with knowledge of what the use was.
Could the appellant just take the fence down?
Could
the easement would still be there. But if the fence just came down, she would then have access to her property, and the easement would still be there. Right now, she's being excluded from it. So what impact does the fact that the fence is there have with regard to this?
Well, as I understand the boundary line agreement, she is not entitled to bring it down. And in fact,
where in any of the documentation, is there any indication that there was an agreement that she would not have access to that property, to her own property?
It's not in the documentation. It is. Our theory at trial was that it was an implied easement by prior use and by the knowledge of the people involved at the time and since, that was what the use for that land was going to be, and they did not complain about it. They had constructive notice of it. But what I also want...
All I'm saying here is the fence is not necessary.
Well, that's what I want to get back to.
Okay, the fence is not necessary for the easement.
Well, I'm not so sure about that.
The boundary line, is it that the trial court had the authority to maintain the fence in place to maintain the easement when the fence has absolutely nothing to do with the easement that was actually implied?
Well, with Your Honor, I respectfully disagree with that. I think that you take the boundary line agreement that says that they can't move the fence by any legal or equitable means, which, by the way, they did file a counterclaim to try to have the fence moved. There was a ultimatum given, exhibits 18 through 20, plaintiff's exhibits, that they were going to tear down that fence, and that she was going to move it back to the property line. Certainly, she had no right to do that.
I can see enjoining her from moving the fence back to the property line, because that would then exclude access to the easement. Okay.
Yes, sir.
What I can't see is prohibiting her from taking down the fence that excludes her from her own property right now. And maybe that's a funky looking half fence where the fence goes away, but at least that gives her access to her property.
The boundary line agreement
otherwise,
doesn't say that.
Otherwise, it basically means that you guys have annexed, Lot 8 has annexed that portion of Lot 7. That's not an easement. That's an annexation, because you're excluding her from it. Okay?
But, Your Honor, again, I would argue that the issue here is whether there's sufficient evidence to support the court's findings, implied findings, mind you, of implied easement by prior estoppel, by prior use, or easement by estoppel, and we believe there is sufficient evidence of that. A lot of these issues were not brought up at trial, were not argued at trial, like the license argument was not this brought up for the first time here. The boundary line agreement doesn't say anything about the use of that 4.5 feet. I grant you that, but our theory at trial was that the parties' behavior, the prior use up to the time she purchased it, with her knowledge of how it was being used, and her acquiescence by conduct after September 15th of 26, all the way through the time Lot 8 was sold in, I want to say, November of 2010, indicated that she agreed with the use being made by Lot 8 of that encroaching 4.5 feet.
Has never been used in the manner that the agreement contemplated.
Perhaps not, Your Honor. Perhaps not. But I would argue that the issue of, the issue of the ability for people to get out of a burning building in a fire, which is what this isn't something that I just came up with. The fire marshal who was there talking to Ms. Janes in 2004. Was saying, in case of a fire with this fence right here, people are going to have a problem. And that's what precipitated this whole thing with Ms. Janes moving that fence. I feel like the boundary line agreement by itself is simply part of the evidence that there was an implied easement by prior use, and certainly an implied easement by estoppel, which has not been challenged, to my knowledge, in this case. And so if that can be upheld, based upon the conduct of Ms. Mooney and the knowledge of Ms. Schwendeman before she bought it, then I believe the judgment should be affirmed on those grounds. The Again, I go back to the elements. I feel like the unity of ownership, the apparent use, the continuous use for 2 years before the sale to Ms. Mooney, her knowledge, and the fact that according to Ms. Janes, whatever the and it's in the record, what the fire marshal told to her was important enough for her to buy the adjoining lot to move so that the hopefully they'll never need to be used as a fire escape, but it can be if it's necessary. I think another part of the issue here is, Your Honor, that there was not only constructive knowledge of what was going on when Ms. Schwendeman, the appellant, purchased this built. She knew from talking to her daughter-in-law, and she knew from the deed records. And yet, I think the problem is that she decided that she was simply going to move the fence without any permission or anything, notwithstanding the boundary line agreement, back to the property line, and exhibits 18 through 20, I believe, show a clear anticipatory repudiation of the boundary line agreement. And if that's the case, then the permanent injunctive relief was, I believe, in this case, justified, because you have a wrongful act and you have immediate and irreparable is this a red light that's just gone on? I can't tell colors to save my life, Your Honor. Thank you very much for your attention.
Thank you, sir. Mr. Carr.
May it please the court again. I believe the evidence is going to show that Ms. Janes bought 7 and 8 at the same time. So she didn't buy 8 and then later buy 7, so that it sounded as what Mr. Mahlers was saying, was that she bought it and then, hey, I think I'll buy 7 so I can move the fence. It didn't happen that way. It was both bought at the same time. There's no evidence there's just no evidence to support any theory of the judgment, so it must be set aside. Strict necessity is the legal standard. It doesn't matter about what Ms. Janes thought, or even what this fire guy said. But if you read what Ms. Janes testified to, the way she said it was that the fireman said, everything is fine as it is, but your tenants, in the event of fire, may have some trouble shimmying between these two perpendicular and the other fence. So that's what the testimony was. The word consent is important here, because if I have the consent to hunt on my nephew's land, which I've done for over 40 years, I do not get an interest in land. I don't have an easement simply because I used it. When Miss Janes moved that fence, she consented to her tenants to use that. She didn't create an easement. She didn't record any document that gave them that right. She simply consented to it. So consent does not rise to prior use. And Miss Mooney testified in her testimony that she did not know they were using it all for backyard. Her understanding was limited to in the event of fire. So,
but she knew the fence was there, and she knew didn't have access to it for 11 years, right?
Yes, sir. But if she consents to that, Judge, then that's okay. That doesn't work against her. She simply consented, thinking, okay, in the event of fire, that's an okay use. She did not consent to him using it as a backyard. The BLA specifically refers to no adverse possession. So if they're arguing prior use, essentially, as you say, Your Honor, that sounds like adverse possession. That is done away with by this BLA. So it can't be by prior use or stacking of time for using it. In the Supreme Court case of Dry, it says, an implied easement must be capable of being clearly defined by the document in issue, as well as possessing the degree of definiteness of its use. There's not a thing in that BLA that says somebody can use or cannot use that property. That the BLA fails on its own. This court stated in the Rice versus Metropolitan Life that courts cannot make contracts for the parties. That's exactly what this trial judge did. He made a contract that was not there. It is wrong. It's a misapplication of the law. There is no evidence to support his theories, and it's an abuse of discretion to the rest of the way. And what I ask the court to do here. Reverse and render, because the law is on our side. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you for your arguments and your briefing in this case. Your case is now submitted, and y'all are excused to go.
Thank you, ma'am. Deposition, which when it was read into court, you were hearing her talk about Exhibit 1 and 2, when in fact, as trial exhibits, they came in as 3 and 4. And Mr. Carr and I have signed this letter agreement. Do you want this letter agreement?
Why don't you give it to the clerk, if
okay.
you would.
All right.
Thank you.
We don't want the court to be confused about numbering.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.